government ever to be elected in Israel, it gave a green light to settler violence, and it was obviously intent on the end game of the whole Zionist project of claiming territorial sovereignty over the whole of so-called promised land or greater Israel.
There's a question here from Mohammed Kaku. What could be the potential long-term solutions to this conflict? The big question, what is possible in the medium to long term here?
Of course, peace was always a possibility. The absence of war was always a possibility. The question is, in whose interests is on the ongoing war? Who profits from it? I think that we really have to ask that kind of a question, both with respect to U.S. support and in Israel itself. Who benefits from the obvious continuation? Of course, you can say the arms industry, but there's also an industry that's built up of a public opinion that is carefully managed, manicured, so that the kinds of questions that are asked, that, for example, this speaker asked, are not asked. How many times in the U.S. press or in U.S. general discourse, whether it's on campuses and more often off, are these kinds of questions raised in an environment that is not hostile? I think that is something that we have a responsibility for that we can affect.
Well, one has to establish a different context than the one that exists now. And that means a different outlook on the part of the Western supporters of Israel, and a different internal Israeli sense of their own interests, their own future. And it's only when substantive pressure is brought to bear on an elite that has gone to these lengths that this current government in Israel has gone to. It is only something very drastic that can shake it from this orientation that can't be measured in material interests alone. It is motivated in part by this kind of visionary Zionism of a maximal sort that sees the necessity of finishing the struggle in such a way as to eliminate the indigenous people as an obstacle to Jewish supremacy. And that's characteristic of settler colonial states. They all, including the U.S. and Canada, they all have acted to neutralize or exterminate the indigenous people. And that's, in my view, what this is all about. This is an effort of maximal Zionism to crush the relevance of Palestinian people. And we should remember that Netanyahu was waving this map around, including in the UN General Assembly, that had no Palestine on it. And one of the motivations, undoubtedly, of Hamas was to negative the view that Palestine could be erased, and the old slogan of a people without a land for a land without a people. That was in this early pre-Balfour Zionist utopian thinking, which erased the Palestinians. As Irene said at the very beginning of our webinar, this is not new. What has happened? It's just an extreme. It's so extreme, it exposes the reality that Israel's state propaganda and control of the public discourse has managed to distort and hide over the years. This is a moment of clarity that shouldn't be diverted by considerations that this is just a matter of bargaining for a mutually acceptable solution.
I want to close with this last question here. And what about Bernie Sanders' initiative in Congress to investigate human rights abuses by countries that receive U.S. aid? I think he's very explicitly introduced a legislation in relationship to Israel. Is this a positive development?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Of course, it will depend on how seriously it's implemented. We look at these formal changes in law as if they're self-enforcing. And what we should have learned is that law is no better, incapable of being effective unless it's backed by effective political enforcement.
I want to thank each of you for sharing your wisdom, and underneath it, I know your passion as well.
Now we will hear from Adila Hassam, representing South Africa in its case at the International Court of Justice.
South Africa contends that Israel has transgressed Article 2 of the Convention by committing actions that fall within the definition of genocide. The actions show a systematic pattern of conduct from which genocide can be inferred. Allow me to place these acts in context. Gaza is one of the two constituent territories of the occupied Palestinian territories, occupied by Israel since 1967. It is a narrow strip of approximately 365 square kilometers. Israel continues to exercise control over the space, territorial waters, land crossings, water, electricity, electromagnetic sphere, and civilian infrastructure in Gaza, as well as over key governmental functions. Entry and exit by air and sea to Gaza is prohibited, with Israel operating the only two crossing points. Gaza, which is one of the most densely populated places in the world, is home to approximately 2.3 million Palestinians, almost half of them children. Israel has subjected Gaza to what has been described as one of the heaviest conventional bombing campaigns in the history of modern warfare. Palestinians in Gaza are being killed by Israeli weaponry and bombs from air, land, and sea. They are also at immediate risk of death by starvation, dehydration, and disease as a result of the ongoing siege by Israel, the destruction of Palestinian towns, the insufficient aid being allowed through to the Palestinian population, and the impossibility of distributing this limited aid while bombs fall. This conduct renders essentials to life unobtainable. At this provisional measures stage, it is not necessary for the court to come to a final view on the question of whether Israel's conduct constitutes genocide. It is necessary to establish only whether at least some of the acts alleged are capable of falling within the provisions of the Convention. On analyzing the specific and ongoing genocidal acts complained of, it is clear that at least some, if not all of these acts, fall within the Convention's provisions. These acts are documented in detail in South Africa's application and confirmed by reliable, often UN, sources. It's thus unnecessary and impossible for me to recount all of them. I will highlight only some in order to illustrate the pattern of genocidal conduct. Against this background, I move now to demonstrate, in turn, how Israel's conduct violates Articles 2A, 2B, 2C of the convention. The first genocidal act committed by Israel is the mass killing of Palestinians in Gaza, in violation of Article 2A of the Genocide Convention. As the UN Secretary General explained, the level of Israel's killing is so extensive that nowhere is safe in Gaza. As I stand before you today, 23,210 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces during the sustained attacks over the last 3 months, at least 70% of whom are believed to be women and children. Some 7,000 Palestinians are still missing, presumed dead under the rubble. Palestinians in Gaza are subjected to relentless bombing wherever they go, and as they try to find food and water for their families. They have been killed if they failed to evacuate in the places to which they have fled, and even while they attempted to flee along Israeli-declared safe routes. The level of killing is so extensive that those whose bodies are found are buried in mass graves, often unidentified. Israel has killed an unparalleled and unprecedented number of civilians. More than 1,800 families, Palestinian families in Gaza, have lost multiple family members, and hundreds of multi-generational families have been wiped out with no remaining survivors, mothers, fathers, children, siblings, grandparents, aunts, cousins, often all killed together. This killing is nothing short of destruction of Palestinian life. It is inflicted deliberately. No one is spared, not even newborn babies. The scale of Palestinian child killings in Gaza is such that UN chiefs have described it as a graveyard for children. The devastation, we submit, is intended to and has laid waste to Gaza beyond any acceptable, legal, let alone humane, justification. The second genocidal act identified in South Africa's application is Israel's infliction of serious bodily or mental harm to Palestinians in Gaza in violation of Article 2B of the Genocide Convention. Israel's attacks have left close to 60,000 Palestinians wounded and maimed. Again, the majority of them women and children. This in circumstances where the healthcare system has all but collapsed. Large numbers of Palestinian civilians, including children, are arrested, blindfolded, forced to undress, and loaded onto trucks taken to unknown locations. The suffering of the Palestinian people, physical and mental, is undeniable. Turning to the third genocidal act under Article 2C, Israel has deliberately imposed conditions on Gaza that cannot sustain life and are calculated to bring about its physical destruction. Israel achieves this in at least four ways. First, by displacement. Israel has forced the displacement of about 85% of Palestinians in Gaza. There is nowhere safe for them to flee to. Those who cannot leave or refuse to be displaced have either been killed or at extreme risk of being killed in their homes. Many Palestinians have been displaced multiple times as families are forced to move repeatedly in search of safety. Israel's first evacuation order on 13 October required the evacuation of over 1 million people, including children, the elderly, the wounded, wounded and infirm. Entire hospitals were required to evacuate even newborn babies in intensive care. The order required them to evacuate the north to the south within 24 hours. The order itself was genocidal. It required immediate movement, taking only what could be carried, while no humanitarian assistance was permitted, and fuel, water, and food, and other necessities of life had deliberately been cut off. It was clearly calculated to bring about the destruction of the population. For many Palestinians, the forced evacuation from their homes is inevitably permanent. Israel has now damaged or destroyed an estimated 355,000 Palestinian homes, leaving at least 500,000 Palestinians with no home to return to. The Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of Internally Displaced Persons explains that houses and infrastructure, quote, have been razed to the ground, frustrating any realistic prospects for displaced Gazans to return home, repeating a long history of mass forced displacement of Palestinians by Israel. There is no indication at all that Israel accepts responsibility for rebuilding what it has destroyed. Instead, the destruction is celebrated by the Israeli army. Soldiers film themselves joyfully detonating entire apartment blocks and town squares, erecting the Israeli flag over the wreckage. Second, together with the forced displacement, Israel's conduct has been deliberately calculated to cause widespread hunger, dehydration, and starvation. Israel's campaign has pushed Gazans to the brink of famine. An unprecedented 93% of the population in Gaza is facing crisis levels of hunger. Of all the people in the world currently suffering catastrophic hunger, more than 80% are in Gaza. The situation is such that the experts are now predicting that more Palestinians in Gaza may die from starvation and disease than airstrikes. And yet Israel continues to impede the effective delivery of humanitarian assistance to Palestinians, not only refusing to allow sufficient aid in, but removing the ability to distribute it through constant bombardment and obstruction. On 8 January, a planned mission by UN agencies to deliver urgent medical supplies and vital fuel to a hospital and medical supply center was denied by Israeli authorities. This marked the fifth denial of a mission to the center since 26 December, leaving 5 hospitals in northern Gaza without access to life-saving medical supplies and equipment. Israel has deliberately inflicted conditions in which Palestinians in Gaza are denied adequate shelter, clothes, or sanitation. Clean water is all but gone, leaving far below the amount required to safely drink, clean, and cook. Accordingly, the WHO has stated that Gaza is experiencing soaring rates of infectious disease outbreaks. Cases of diarrhea in children under 5 years of age have increased 2,000% since hostilities began. When combined and left untreated, malnutrition and disease create a deadly cycle. The fourth genocidal act under Article 2B is Israel's military assault on Gaza's healthcare system, which renders life unsustainable. Even by 7 December, the UN Special Rapporteur on the right to health noted that the health care of infrastructure in the Gaza Strip has been completely obliterated. Those wounded by Israel in Gaza are being deprived of life-saving medical care. Gaza's healthcare system, already crippled by years of blockade and prior attacks by Israel, is unable to cope with the sheer scale of the injuries. In sum, Madam President, all of these acts, individually and collectively, form a calculated pattern of conduct by Israel, indicating a genocidal intent. This intent is evident from Israel's conduct in specially targeting Palestinians living in Gaza, using weaponry that causes large-scale homicidal destruction, as well as targeted sniping of civilians, designating safe zones for Palestinians to seek refuge, and then bombing these, depriving Palestinians in Gaza of basic needs, food, water, healthcare, fuel, sanitation, and communications, destroying social infrastructure, homes, schools, mosques, churches, hospitals, and killing, seriously injuring, and leaving large numbers of children orphaned. Genocides are never declared in advance. But this court has the benefit of the past 13 weeks of evidence that shows incontrovertibly a pattern of conduct and related intention that justifies a plausible claim of genocidal acts. Every day, there is mounting irreparable loss of life, property, dignity, and humanity for the Palestinian people. Our news feeds show graphic images of suffering that has become unbearable to watch. Nothing will stop the suffering except an order from this court. Without an indication of provisional measures, the atrocities will continue, with the Israeli Defense Force indicating that it intends pursuing this course of action for at least a year. In the words of the UN Undersecretary General on 5 January 2024, I quote, "Constant bombardments, poor communications, damaged roads, convoys shot at, delays at checkpoints, a traumatized and exhausted population crammed into a smaller and smaller sliver of land, shelters which have long exceeded their full capacity, aid workers themselves displaced, killed. This is an impossible situation for the people of Gaza and for those trying to help them. The fighting must stop." Close quote. Madam President, members of the court, that concludes my section on the genocidal conduct of Israel. I thank you for your patient attention.
You were just listening to Adila Hassam on Gaza, a case of genocide. She represented South Africa at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, Netherlands, on January 11th. Before that, we heard from Richard Falk and Irene Genzier. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Max Blumenthal, Chris Hedges, Norman Finkelstein, and Phyllis Bennis. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Adila Hassam, Richard Falk, and Irene Genzier on Gaza, A Case of Genocide, and for the Edward Said book, Culture and Resistance, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977, or you can go online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Joseph Gerson. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Dana Sala singing Ta'alin to those of you climbing the mountain.
يا طول عين عين للجبل يا مول المقيدين النار بين لليامان يامان عين للهنا يا روح ما بيتي منك للكم خلعة ولا لا 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 بدي زنار بين لليامان يامان عين للهنا يا روح إلا
Thank you.